Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of August. Let me remind you, you already know today is primary day in the state, and a reminder that tonight the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio is bringing you coverage of what we do today. It's Wisconsin primary election coverage hosted by WPR's Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg. They'll have analysis, the results of the races, polling updates starting at 8 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. This hour, Doc Searles is going to be joining us. He came to our attention by actually, I've known him for a long, long time, but he wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal. It was an essay, "The Customer as a God. Businesses today tend to herd customers as if they were cattle, but a revolution in personal empowerment is underway, and buying will never be the same again." Doc wrote that. It captivated us, and we said we need to have him on the air. He is the author of a book that has more information than what is based in that essay. The Intention Economy goes into great detail about what he talks about in the Wall Street Journal. The Intention Economy has recently been published. Doc is senior editor of Linex Journal. He is also a co-author of Clue Train Manifesto. He's an alumnus fellow with Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, a fellow with the Center for Information Technology and Society at the University of California. He's also quite an accomplished photographer, committed to enlarging the sum of images that are in the public domain. He writes a highly entertaining blog on many different subjects, and he is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Doc.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great.
Good.
Great.
The article captivated us, and I love your blog. Your blog is really wonderful on all these subjects that I think about, but I didn't know that you wrote about those.
Yeah, it's kind of a vintage blog. It's been around since 1999. I was one of the – it came in early because I discovered that, you know, if you want to say original things, it's kind of hard to get them published, and I knew some people who were early in the blogging movement and talked me into doing that, and I've been going at it ever since, just having fun with it.
Mm-hmm. The Wall Street Journal article talks about, and let's just take it from Saturday morning in 2022 and tell the story.
Well, what I was trying to do is anticipate what's going to happen when tools that are just now beginning to come into the marketplace that allow us to control our own data, to set our own terms of service, to, as it were, advertise our own intentions in the marketplace, would have their full implications. It's kind of like sitting in 1995 and wondering what a browser would do or what having your own email would do. And so and there are many, many things that can come from this and inevitably will, but again, it's very early. One is being able to say, for example, you know, I need a stroller for twins in Central Park in the next 2 hours. I have $200. Who's coming through? Without giving up any more personal information than is required and without having to go to what in technology we call silos, going to only Craigslist or only eBay or only Amazon, because we should be able to address the entire marketplace rather than just one intermediary. And once that happens, we'll be much more in charge of the activities in the marketplace and of our own lives. Right now, we're very accustomed. We're kind of like boiled frogs in our acquiescence to captivity. We're used to being held captive by sellers. They want to do that. That's part of an ethos that's been around since industry won the Industrial Revolution, and we're quite used to it. But it's not the end state, I don't think. The full implications of the Internet are that we will be free and will be much more autonomous actors in the marketplace.
Tell me how they control us now, Doc. I'm always astounded when I look at Facebook or whatever I look at, and there's all this information that makes me think that somebody's been looking at what I read and who I'm talking to. I just am astounded by the information they have about me. It's slightly offensive, actually.
It is. It's creepy. But the fortunate thing about it is there's not a somebody looking at you. There are robots. And
Robots.
They're robots, and they're actually not very good at it. If you look at your Facebook ads, unless you block them, as many of us do, like about 10, almost 10% of us block ads in general, but with browser extensions. But if you see them, you're going to notice that, you know, a very, very small percentage of them are appropriate in any way. It's remarkable how they can know so much about you and really get it wrong a lot of the time. I get ads for under 30 singles, for fly fishing. I've never been fly fishing in my life. I gave up fishing when I was about 13 and got tired of it. It's amazing how lousy the information often is. And Google has better information, actually, because you have intent when you go there, and they're busy customizing. But the problem we have right now is that there's this assumption on the part of the people operating the advertising system, which is changing every day. But there's this assumption that they can have perfect knowledge of you, that because they see what you're searching for and they see where you've been and they've followed you with your apps on your phone and the rest of this, that they can guess what you're going to do next. And that's offensive to our humanity. It's offensive to our sense of individual autonomy and agency and those things that define us as human beings. But it's fashion right now in the internet, in the kind of commercial web industry, and a lot of money is going into this. So it's going to get worse before it gets better, I think. But I'm very optimistic about it getting better because there's a limit to how bad it can get, and we're probing that right now.
So how do we change that? How do we, as you suggest in the article in the Wall Street Journal, move toward full empowerment of individuals, making them independent of those controlling organizations, and also giving them the power so we engage with them rather than them dictating to us?
Well, again, as I said, it's early. So, you know, it's actually more like 1994 than 95. It's sort of like before the first browsers are out. There's a class of development of new software and services called VRM, for Vendor Relationship Management. That's kind of the user side counterpart of customer relationship management, which most of us who are not in business only know is what gives us call centers and loyalty cards and things that annoy us like that. Mm-hmm. We can't improve those very well unless we have tools on our side that say, for example, here are my terms of service, which say things like, give me back my data when you're done. The data will look like this. Don't track me. I'm going to keep track of my own data, and here's how it's going to look to me, and here's what I'm going to share with you and under what conditions. And that stuff is just beginning to show up right now. So, and that's the project I've been working on for the last almost 6 years at the Berkman Center at Harvard. When I got a fellowship here in 2006, I set about sort of fostering this development class. Some of it had already been going on, but it acquired that three-letter acronym, which is very forgettable except inside the business. But I think the main thing to do is watch for developments that make you as a customer, not as a consumer, because we're not just consuming anymore, we're producing, but as a customer more independent. What is it that makes us more independent? And start using those tools as they show up. Ad blocking is one, and there are tracking, blocking tracking on your browser is another thing to do. Look for tracker blocking as a possibility. There are a number of companies doing that right now. One is Disconnect Me, another is Ghostery. There's one called Collusion that's by Mozilla that produces Firefox. There's Privacy Watch, and there's one called Privowny, Privowny. Those are just a few of the early ones you can download and use right now.
How do you even know about these, Doc? You would because of what you do, but how would we know about it?
You wouldn't, for the most part. They're not advertising. They're not in the big publicity mills that are out there. Several years ago, I had an experience with publicity where we had some early developments, and I started talking about it. I'm pretty good at getting publicity, and it was too much too early. There wasn't enough out there yet, and so we've really been laying kind of low in this development, but it's getting about ready right now. That I think the stuff coming out of the oven now that's best, I think, is the stuff for blocking tracking. Microsoft has actually been a really good company on this lately. The new version of Internet Explorer and of Windows 8 is going to have Do Not Track by default in your browser. This is not something that enforces not tracking, but something that is a signal back to the website that this user doesn't want to be tracked. And that's an important thing because for 17 years, ever since we first invented the graphical browser and the first commercial websites, we've had as a default that all the responsibility is on the site side.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to start seeing more responsibility on the user side. And that's the first effort in that direction.
And do you need some kind of device to do all of this? So we're talking about a new kind of technology? A new
phone, not really.
Or something? No.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think, first of all, the interesting thing about phones is that we're only renting them. We only have them for a couple of years at the most. Apple and Google with the iPhone and with Android are moving along so fast, and the new phones are going to be so much better than the old ones. Nothing is older than a three-year-old iPhone right now, and your iPhone 4S even will seem really old after the iPhone 5 comes out and the new Androids as well. There are going to be lots of apps there that are going to give us more control, and that's, again, a matter of time. There's also software being written that allows you to start programming your interactions between apps. There's a company called Kinetix, K-Y-N-E-T-X, in Utah that has some code for doing that. Now, that's not something that you or I would want to do, but something that new companies and new development groups are going to come along and say, wait a minute, you can start connecting all these things like an Erector set or like almost like Tinker Toys where you can have logic, you know, if I'm in Milwaukee and so-and-so is in town, then make sure this other thing happens. Or fill out an expense report for me or make these different connections between things. That is something that's going to be new and make the apps that we use now less siloed, which is to say working only with themselves. And, you know, and on the browsers, too, we're going to see a lot of improvements in that direction.
How influential are marketers in holding up privacy tools on browsers?
On an individual basis, not at all. On a collective basis, quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say holding it up. They're not holding it up, really. There's not much money yet in protecting your privacy. There's not much money yet in making you autonomous in the marketplace. There will be. As soon as we have the ability to express intent with money on the barrelhead, you know, for example, you can say, you know what, I want the Ford F-150 truck with the white seats and the certain tires when the price comes down to $45,000, and I've got that money escrowed in a bank right now, ready for the first one that comes through. We're at work right now, some of us, with banks on this very prospect, and that's a matter of time before that happens. And once the economic benefits to the sell side are evident, then we'll start seeing more money going into development on the buyer's side. But right now, the big money is all in this thing they call big data, which I think is way oversold and assumes that, you know, that these sites and their back-end advertising systems, which again are all robotic, are going to know you perfectly. It's going to take a while to prove that wrong.
Mm-hmm. You wrote in a recent blog, and I think about this almost every day, Doc, that it is absolutely astounding how the world has changed. And you list three things, the personal computer, the internet, and the smartphone. But my goodness, has it changed our lives, hasn't it?
It's amazing that my younger son, who's 15 years old, and I have, about a year ago, year and a half ago, I wrote about this in the book, we're watching Blade Runner, which came out in, I think, 83 or 84. It was set in 2019 or 2018, something like that. And there were zero gravity cars, and Los Angeles was this dystopia, and there were buildings the size of mountains, but they were still using payphones and the computers. They had TVs, you know, and the computers had green phosphors on the screen. What we have now, there's a long revolution that's going on, and I think it's happened so slowly that we haven't really fully grokked, I think, the full implications of it. But what happened with the personal computer is it gave us data processing power. This is something that used to live only in large organizations, governments, and big business. Suddenly, we had the power to do that. And we, as individuals, could do so much more than companies could do with information and with programs and many other things. And millions of programs came out, and, you know, probably billions of computers were sold. And we could do so much more. But that gave us some individual power, but it wasn't until the internet came along realistically in 1995 with the graphical browser and with email and with ISPs, that suddenly we had the power to communicate with anybody else in the world as if they were no distance apart and at almost no cost. And this was these two things, having a great deal of personal power in computation and having the power to communicate anywhere in the world as if it was zero distance away, were both huge. And with smartphones, we put all that in our pocket. But because the smartphones are basically owned by the phone companies, they're owned by Apple, we're not quite there yet. They're still, the big guys are still to some degree in control. It'll take a few more years before that system breaks as well, I think, and we have full independence. And we move from the kind of social network time that we're in now to the full implications of what the internet and personal computing gave us, which is that we all have a great deal of autonomy and personal power and the ability to construct our own social networks in our own ways without having to go to a Facebook or to a Twitter or some other thing like that.
Yeah, give me an idea of how that would work. I'm not sure I fully understand that.
Well, I think what's going to happen is that the tools will be out there. Like right now, there isn't a single simple tool that says, you know what, I'm going to set up a Twitter account, not an account, but it will set up a Twitter system just for me and my family, where I'm not being tracked. It's just us. And I've got it on a server here somewhere, and I'm running it, but I don't have to be a techie to do that. That's not possible yet in an easy way. We have to go to a Facebook or we have to go to some big system in the sky in order to make that happen. So. Mm-hmm. But it'll change.
Mm. And what about being a techie? I am so far from being a techie, and I feel like I'm missing a step here, Doc, because, you know, everybody who's younger than me, and that's a lot of people these days.
But they
all seem to just get it, and you get it, and I don't get a lot of it. I sometimes feel, and there have to be people like me, who need some understanding of how to access all of this, how to make sure you get it right, how to make sure you're not wasting your time when you're looking at all kinds of information, of targeting what it is you need to know, and just using the equipment, for heaven's sake.
It's hard. If you're not steeped in it, it's hard. And it's true that the kids pick it up faster. And, you know, I've been a techie all along. I mean, I changed bulbs on radio station towers even before I met you back in North Carolina.
Right.
You shouldn't have to know. See, that's the interesting thing. Mm. You don't need to know to drive a car. You shouldn't need to know how to change a tire or even know how to change the oil. Most of us don't, and it's not a problem. I mean, when I 30 years ago when we met, I always had a box of tools in the trunk of my car. I didn't know when that thing was going to break down. You know, that was the norm even still. You know, that as recently as that. And we don't anymore. We rely on cars to be pretty solid. And we all learn how to drive. It's not that hard. And it'll be like that. And I think that the car actually is a very good model for what we really want in a personal device. I wouldn't say a smartphone because I think there's something that comes after that. But something that is just ours and we know how to use it and it's easy. And we don't have to download an app to do it. It'll be just, you know, we want to form our own little social network just for friends. We want to put up photos just for people we know. We'll be able to discriminate, saying, you know, that person isn't that close a friend, or I don't need to know too much about that other person over there. We don't need somebody else to tell us who our friends are and how our friends are friends and all that kind of stuff,
right,
which a big
right.
company will try to do. The sad thing about Facebook is they invented AOL all over again. And I think that was a big step backwards. It's a big success, and it's kind of normative right now, but I think it's a redwood that does not grow to the sky and will fall down eventually. All companies do.
And how long will it take? How long will this be?
Well, in the book I said 2013, so I talked about the great social media crash of 2013. I think there, you know, we're seeing it happen in the stock market a little bit, but I think we need the inventions that Mother Necessity. That's what an iPhone was. I remember a few years ago, I gave my wife a Nokia phone that had a keyboard on it, so I could text with her. And she texted me one word. It was the word no, and that was it for about 2 or 3 years. And then she saw an iPhone, and one day she said, "I got to have an iPhone. I can use that." And she's very conservative in what she uses, and she doesn't like to waste her time, and she is still teaching me about how to use the iPhone because she's so adept at it. And that's that was the genius of that product at the time, that it was possible to take something that complex and make it easy to use. And it's not as easy as it could be, and there are a lot of people that are still daunted by it. But really, it shouldn't have to be hard. But, you know, designing for ease of use is a hard thing to do. And now that Steve Jobs is gone, I think it'll get a little bit slower.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls for Doc Searles, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Doc came to our attention, well, now we know him for all kinds of reasons, but he came to our attention from a Wall Street Journal article that was written fairly recently, a Saturday essay. And the essay is based on his new book, The Intention Economy, When Customers Take Charge. He is a fellow with the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, and also a fellow with the Center for Information Technology and Society at the University of California, Santa Barbara. So if you have questions about this VRM that he has written about, if you have thoughts about, thoughts about are being in control of all of this rather than companies mining information about us. How do we switch all of that so that it can be working for us instead of they're telling us what it is that we should be interested in? And just this general larger picture of technology and what it has done to our lives, which I think is so significant, the personal computer, the internet, the smartphone, all of those, and what's next. What's next in all of those areas? We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number. Just a reminder, it's election day. It seems like it's always election day in Wisconsin, but there is an important primary, and we will be presenting live coverage of the Wisconsin primary election tonight starting at 8 o'clock. Sean Johnson from WPR, Frederica Freiberg from Wisconsin Public Television will be with us, and they will give us poll updates. There will be political analysis and more tonight, 8 o'clock, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Doc Searles, our guest this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we have lines open for you right now. Peter in Middleton is our first caller. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I just had one comment and a question. First of all, I just, from the iProducts, I can't say enough about them. They have an intuitive compatibility that makes them so easy to use, and I was a person that used PCs and things like that, and just held my breath every time I got online. But the iProducts seem to be intuitively sort of geared for humans. But the question I had was that the doc mentioned something about something beyond the smartphones, and I'm not sure what it was, and I'd like to hear that.
Okay.
Well, we don't have a name for it yet because, you know, nobody's invented it. There's markets work two ways. One is necessity is the mother of invention, and the other is invention is the mother of necessity. What happened with the iPhone was that Steve Jobs and company invented something we needed because we saw it and said we got to have that. Something will follow. I have no doubt about it. What I said in the article, and probably in the earlier draft, it was a bit longer, went into a little bit more detail about it. I think we will have personal devices that are not phones with computers in them, but rather computers that do many things, including what we now call telephony. But we don't need the phone system in order to do that. We don't need phone numbers. We just have our contact list, and we have ways of reaching them, and we have ways of doing things. But somebody's going to have to invent that. That's fallow ground. Start a company. Go make that. That's harder than it sounds, but that's really what the challenge is. My guess is that in the long run, Apple or Google or somebody will try to do that. But we'll see. There is no name for it yet, though.
What do we do? You wrote a blog about this, and it's semi-related, but it answers a question I have, and I'm sure others do as well. Don't we run a risk of inventing all these things so quickly that what you had that you thought was terribly sophisticated becomes obsolete? Or you have all this information. I have, you know, tons and tons of cassette tapes and even reel-to-reel tapes, which you'll remember, Doc, from years ago, that there's no way to play all this information anymore. Or VCRs where you interviewed your dad about World War II and you got to change all this information. You need some place to be able to play all of it. It's a little bit irritating.
It's a tough one. I think that we do have some standards that are developed now. The for audio, there's the 44.1, which is the CD standard, which is, you know, and there's MP3 and MPEG-4. Those are probably going to be around for a while. Converting your videos and audios to current standards are probably going to make them durable, but then again, they're not on a physical medium anymore. You lose your hard drive and you're out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one, and it's a real challenge right now. And I've been speaking to a lot of people about this lately, about what market opportunity there might be in there. Right now, Apple is a little bit ahead in some ways, but nobody's really dealing with the storage issue. I have, like, you know, 6 or 8 terabytes worth of data, including, like, lots of photographs, as you mentioned earlier. I have no idea how to store these well. I live on 2 coasts. And on the road a lot, the upstream capacity on most internet connections is terrible because the internet, as we know it now, has been optimized for downstream, for television, basically. And as TV moves to the net, it's going to get worse again before it gets better. That's a market opportunity. Right now, it's a big problem, and it's only going to get bigger because we're producing more and more data all the time, and storing it is a real problem. But I think it'll be solved, but it's going to take a while.
So what do you do with all that stuff? If you have stuff on tape, if you have cassettes, et cetera, how do you make sure that you're storing that, not just for the next couple of years, but forever?
You could do what I do. I put them all in a hot garage and hope it lives, you know, which it probably won't. I have, like you have, a zillion old reel-to-reel tapes, you know, including the Dr. Dave stuff I did at WDBS
a
thousand years ago. But I hate to visit it. I actually have a reel-to-reel machine at my house. It was actually abandoned. I found it in a house that we moved into, and somebody left it there. And it works quite well, and most of the tapes that I tested 2 or 3 years ago survived. But I have no idea about the cassette tapes. You know, the mechanisms are wear out, the tapes rot. On the other hand, they do exist, and there's a risk of non-existence for data. So nobody's worked that one out yet. And this thing about the cloud, just put it all in the cloud. Well, you fail to pay for that 1 month and it goes away. Well, that's not a good deal. You know, then you just, you know, it's oblivion for whatever you've saved that way. So there is not a good answer for that. I think it's a huge opportunity. I've been talking to some people about what can be done just this morning, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you were? Well, good for you. So yeah. You're going to do that for us, right, Doc?
Well, somebody will. It won't be me. I'm too old for that. I'm the guy who just encourages other people to go do that. So, yeah.
You're not too old for it. You got time left in you. You know this field pretty well. And that is interesting that there is sort of a generation. I mean, you're an exception to all of this, but there's this generational difference in all of this, that there is something about this is a field that seems to be benefiting people who are younger, although it shouldn't necessarily. It should be something that benefits all of us.
It's interesting. I mean, I was at a wedding this last week and in California, and I was the only one with, like, a real, you know, SLR Canon camera. Everybody else is shooting with their phones, you know, or you know, there's hardly anybody even videotaping taping isn't even a word anymore. Video recording the thing. Everybody's holding up these things. And did you see the closing of the Olympics? Like, all the athletes are walking around holding their phones up in the air, shooting each other with this stuff.
Right.
Well, in addition to this being pretty low quality stuff, it's also very evanescent. I don't know where they're storing it. I don't know how long they're keeping it, or even if they want to keep it. That's an open question to me. I'm sort of amazed. It's one of the ways that there is a generational gap for me. It's clear to me they're using Instagram, they're using Pinterest, they're putting it up on Facebook to some extent and some other places. But is there any intention to archive this for the long term? I don't know. I think the photo has become like a text. It's something that's that snow on the water. It just disappears, and it's there's no. But I don't know. That's one of the areas where maybe one of your callers has the answer, but I don't. I'm a little bit flummoxed by it. I want my photos to last, and I don't know if people shooting it with a phone want that.
Oh, that's interesting. I can't imagine not wanting to keep it, particularly at an event that's such a monumental event like a wedding.
Well, the interesting thing is that everybody who saw the photos that I put together and I put up on Flickr, which is something I've used a lot, and in a private mode just for family members, were very impressed by them. Wow, what a great boot. You know, are they going to put those up? Yeah, we want those. So I think that there are people like me and people who appreciate people like me shooting old-fashioned type, let's say, considered, fairly high-quality photographs. They continue to want that. I don't think photography is going to go away. But I think casual photography is not, there's a whole different ethos around that. I don't know.
And what does that say about us that we're not archiving that? That says something significant, doesn't it, Doc?
It does. But who's the we? I mean, I'm archiving it, but I'm 65 years old. And I know some people a generation behind who are also archiving it, but the younger folks, I don't know what they're doing with it. I mean, obviously it goes into iPhoto, and iPhoto gets bigger and bigger, but you have enough of these. I have a friend who's a younger guy whose wife shoots a lot of video for the family and for church groups and everything else like that, and he's put in a giant server in his basement that does nothing but store this stuff, and he's not even sure it's big enough for that, and he's a really technical guy. So if it weren't for him, where would she put all this? I have no idea.
Well, let's ask people, too, particularly among younger listeners. What are you doing with these pictures that you take? Is it there for a while and then you just let it go? Do you feel a need to archive this information? I think that that's a significant change. We have phone lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Doc Searles is our guest this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Doc has written several books. He wrote, if you want a reference, and I think we'll have it on our Facebook page, a piece in the Wall Street Journal that caught our attention, and he is the author of The Intention Economy, When Customers Take Charge. He argues that we need to become smarter consumers in order to propel us into the intention economy in which demand will drive supply far more directly, efficiently, and compellingly than ever before. Tons of phone calls now. We'll take them in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Doc Searles, our guest, and let's go to Nate in Madison. Hi, Nate.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Quick point. I think Doc is saying some really interesting things, the use of iPhones and portable devices to capture photography. I don't know if it's been mentioned yet, but that technology is really advancing quickly, allowing friends and family to, snap really high-quality photos of things. And I think the question of archiving is an interesting one. People are still using Flickr and Tumblr, but I also noticed people are immediately uploading to Facebook, where not only themselves but their friends and family are saving them to, hard drives of their own. So we've seen exponential archiving, maybe lower quality, but definitely broader scope. So that's what I wanted to note. Thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
Actually, what I'd like to ask Doug is or some other caller is, what happens when Facebook fails or when Flickr fails? That's my big fear. I have 50,000 photos on Flickr. And it's owned by Yahoo, and Yahoo's been in trouble. What happens if they die? I have no idea. I don't want to contemplate that. But it's any of these. I mean, you're saving it for yourself, but then all hard drives eventually die. So then what? I've got albums that go back to photo albums that go back to 18 something or other, and they still exist. I don't know if digital media that we have today are going to exist in another 100 years.
Oh, I'm worried about that, Doc. You're going to have to do something. I don't want you to lose them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, don't lose them. When you talk about Facebook, you think Facebook is going to fail?
Yeah. I think all companies fail eventually. There's a really good talk on TED by a guy named Jeffrey West. There's Jeffrey with a G. On why cities live and companies die. And you can bomb a city and somehow it survives. Most cities do. And it's because they're networks. And networks tend to survive, whereas standalone closed systems don't. And with companies, we make closed systems. One of the things I'm hoping that will emerge in the intention economy is more consciousness on the part of companies of the interconnectedness between them and the need for dependencies that transcend the very narrow interest that companies tend to have. And I'm hopeful that that's going to happen. I'm speculating that it will, but I probably won't live to see it proven or disproven. But I think that, you know, the modern corporation, as we understand it, is only as old as industry. And industry, as we know it, is only about 150, 160 years old. It's not been around a long time in the scale of human history. And I think that there's an evolutionary stage that we're going to have to go through where we realize that companies don't exist for Wall Street. They don't exist to make a profit. They exist to make shoes, as Peter Drucker put it. They exist to, you know, to produce radio, to make devices, to do other things that are passions of people and the people that work there, and not just ways to produce a surplus of money. And I say that as somebody who loves business and wants to see business thrive, but I think that business is broader than just returning value to stockholders. And nobody goes into business saying, geez, I can't wait to return value to stockholders. It's because you really want to start that restaurant. You really want to start this thing. But there's an interconnectedness there that I think the human beings on the inside and the ones on the outside, by connecting better than they are now, are going to help improve business so the companies live. But I don't see that happening with Facebook. I think Facebook is epiphenomenal.
Jeff in Two Rivers, hi.
Oh, good morning to you. I have a comment and a question, I guess. I repair computers in the technology world. The thing that I'm finding in this day and age is that a lot of people taking video and taking digital photographs, I've been finding that their hard drives failed, they come in and or their cameras on their phone have failed, and they can no longer recover this information. Had a lady did all video of her sister's wedding, and she brought her computer in because it failed. The whole wedding was like unretrievable, and so that was my comment reference to versus the old 35 millimeter video is there forever. You look at it for the 1600s versus today. Your hard drive fails or your phone fails. It's like, well, you know, our vacation is now non-existent, and I'll take my comment off the air, is there a plan C for these people? Of course, I've always tell everybody, back up is everything, but like all habits, people don't back up until they say, oh, I should have backed up.
Doc.
Yeah, well, plan A is also plan B and plan C and plan D. You know, it's there's an old saying, and I'm sure the caller knows as well, that there are two kinds of people. You know, those who have experienced a hard drive failure, and those who will. And I've lost count. I have at least dozens of dead hard drives that since I started doing computing, I guess in the late 80s. And I have floppy drives that nothing will read at this point, and it's a big problem. And backing up is the answer, and there's not enough room in any of the backup systems that I know of for somebody who's doing a lot of photography. I mean, Apple's biggest backup thing, it's called Time Machine, and if you're just using the software, it's Time Capsule. If you use the device, it goes up to 3 terabytes now. That's actually not much if you're shooting video. And ours has failed. We have one; it's already died, and we're backing up on other things now. Fortunately, we were able to recover what we lost there. But it's still, it's a huge issue. And I'm amazed that it doesn't get talked about more. People who repair computers see it all the time. By the way, there's a company called Drive Savers that you give them the raw hard drive, they will try to recover something from it, but it's very, very expensive. I advise everybody to back up as much as you can, but there is not a plan B or C yet. There will be. I'm optimistic about that, but right now there isn't.
Jeff, thank you. Ross in Blanchardville. Hi, Ross.
Hi. My concern is people like me who are up there in age who have taken pictures and slides, I should say, for many years. You know, 600 of them are from before Don, my husband and I were married, and then the rest of them, which goes into oblivion, were of our children growing up. And how do I get those things documented? And I'd like to get maybe one disc and then duplicate that disc for my children. How do I do that? How do I get to that point?
Thank you, Rose.
I would go online and look for companies that will do that for you. I mean to do it. I actually brought all of my slides from California and North Carolina to Boston with the sincere intention of finding some company where I could just hand them the box and say, give this back to me on a disc along with the originals. It can be done. There are companies that do this, and I highly recommend doing that instead of getting your own scanner. I actually did get a scanner and realized it would take me forever to do it. So, I wouldn't use it again. I mean, there's no, you need to do this just one time, but get it done in a format, and I'm not sure what would be the best one, but that's going to last for a long time. I don't have the, I wish I could think of one. I wouldn't even begin to say it, but there should be one nonetheless. Go do that.
Go do that. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Find a company to do it for you.
Thanks, Rose. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lines have been busy. You can get through now. I want to talk a little bit more about your photography, Doc, because you started, I guess, as a newspaper photographer, and you have made great contributions to newspapers and to NBC's 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. You've done a lot with photography.
And most of it's been very passive on my part in a certain way. What I like to do, I mean, is shoot photos of things that ought to be in Wikipedia, for example. I'd love to put them in the public domain. So there's a licensing standard, a set of standards called Creative Commons, that allows you to license your photos, say, for attribution only. This is how I have mine done, is attribution only, meaning that if somebody else uses it, they're free to use it, just they have to attribute it to me. If I could put them in the public domain, if that was a possibility on Flickr, it used to be, but it's not anymore, I would do that. I shoot a lot of photos out the windows of airplanes, of interesting geology, of small towns. There are, I think, hundreds of photos of mine that illustrate a town. The airport in Denver is one of them. That I've shot from airplanes, and that's a sort of a calling on my part. I think that it's kind of a calling of civilization for us to leave it better than we found it. And photography is one skill that I have. I'm not a great photographer. I consider myself a good enough photographer, but I just like to shoot lots of stuff that people will look, you know, people can use. Just, you know, put that stuff into the world and let people use it. So that's what Flickr is useful for me, but it's not. And every once in a while, somebody will pay me for one. But I think maybe over the years, it may maybe $500 or $600. But
oh my goodness, Doug! Yeah. Well, yeah. There can't.
Oh, then the NBC. The funny thing with the NBC story is that they contacted me and said, "We see this as attribution only, but can we use these? We can't attribute it every single time we use them, but we'd like to use them as a graphic element." They're actually crystal. Ice photos that I shot on the window of our apartment here near Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they turned out to be, next to the five rings, or whatever number those rings are, the most used element in NBC's coverage of the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. And later somebody said to me, while the Olympics were going on, didn't you ask him for tickets or something? And I thought, it never occurred to me. And I contacted my guy there, and he said, yeah, no, come on out. But it was too late by then, and I never did it. So... but I probably could have, you know, traded them for a perk of some kind, but I never bothered.
You function on a different plane, Doc. There are many people in America who function that way.
Out of the goodness, no, there aren't. But
no. Sheila in Ricetown. Hi, Sheila.
Hello. A while back, I took a bunch of my pictures that I had on my computer and went to a company called Peekaboo. And I think there are a lot of companies out there that will do this. You can upload your pictures. And in my case, I didn't even organize them. I didn't do anything with them. I just uploaded them all. And the software automatically put them into some kind of order in a photo album. and printed it and sent it to my house. So that, I think, is my plan A, plan B, put it on paper. That is one way that you don't have to worry about something crashing, you know, unless your house burns down. But then another comment I have is I had a very dear friend pass away a couple years ago, and I was going through her 8 million photographs that she had not yet done anything with. And I found it really interesting that, you know, you take a lot of pictures of scenery, you take a lot of pictures of things like that, and when you're gone and nobody knows what it is, it's really valuable to nobody. I mean, unless it's
right.
a really fantastic picture of something that other people are aware of.
This is an interesting issue. I have in North Carolina, I have five male cousins, all my age and a little bit younger, whose mother died quite a few years ago, but shot an enormous number of photographs. And when they went, and after their father died as well, they went through her stuff, and they threw away every photo where they didn't know people. They weren't marked very well, and it was exactly that same situation. My advice, actually, if you can, is to save them. And one of the things that's coming along is facial recognition. And I think it's going to be possible in the fullness of time to take a lot of these old photos, scan them or send them to some bulk scanning operation and put them up saying, who are these people, you know, in some place, and have some service like this Peekaboo one, you know, recognize them for you. I mean, it's creepy in some ways because, you know, facial recognition is something that we don't want machines to do, we want people to do. But on the other hand, that can have enormous archival possibilities. You know, that it would be nice to know who those soldiers were with my father in the pictures from World War II. He's gone, he can't identify them, but I have the shots and I've put them up online and I've identified him and I've identified where he is or where he was when it was shot. And every once in a while, in a long time, somebody will come along and say, I know that. But as an example of how media deteriorates. My grandfather, of whom I have a few pictures, was the chief carpenter for D.W. Griffith shooting silent movies in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Oh, was he really? Huh.
Yeah, and all of the archives from Fort Lee, New Jersey were A, burned or lost because it was on this old nitrate stock that rotted. Huh. So there are remarkably few examples of those movies from those times, just because the archiving that was done was so poor. So... You know, and by the way, in respect to Peekaboo, there's Shutterfly is another one of those. There are a lot of sites online where you can upload photos. They'll organize them for you.
Hmm. Give us some suggestions of great places to go to on the web. You must be a total expert in this area, Doc.
Oh, my God. Well, to me, my favorite by far is Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia is one of the great accomplishments of civilization.
You do?
yeah, absolutely. The fact that people will go in there and just volunteer to help. It's a great big barn raising, and that to me is growing up, I loved to just look at the encyclopedia, and Wikipedia does the same thing for me now. And it's becoming more valuable now that the web has become so commercialized. Right now, if you search for a lot of things, the first page of results or the first several pages of results will be commercial things. And we're not always looking to buy something. Often we just want to know, what is the height of Mount Everest? What is, you know, where is the Ganges River? What were the lyrics for that tune? That's something my son and I often do. He'll go pull out the iPad or whatever, and there'll be some old song that I'm listening to, and I never knew what that lyrics were, you know, because they were mumbled or something. And, you know, and Steve Miller sings of the pompousness of love. What is that? he'll look that stuff up and tell me, well, there is no pompousness of love. He just said that. But Wikipedia to me is just like it's the whole thing. To me, that's why a big reason why we made the web.
Hmm. And you're doing photos for that too, aren't you?
The interesting thing is I've not put a single one of those photos there. There are hundreds of them there, and I just put them up on Flickr, put them in the public domain. Somebody looks for, I'm thinking, Thetford, Nebraska, for example. there's the Nebraska, if you fly over the country a lot like I do, you'll notice that in the middle of Nebraska, there's these rectangular, large rectangular patches of green. What are those? You know, is this otherwise just sand hills, and what are those doing there? And I looked it up on Wikipedia. Turns out this is a national forest created by some guy from Denver who thought he could foliate Nebraska and tried for those many square miles that are rectangular and have not expanded beyond those borders. And the nearest town is the one called Thetford. And I put up a picture of that. In a matter of days, somebody had found it and stuck it on Wikipedia to illustrate that town.
Mm.
I've put nothing there. It all goes from people find it, they stick it on something called Wikimedia Commons.
Mm-hmm.
And Wikimedia Commons is a collection of images that you can use easily and without having to clear rights for them. It's a wonderful thing.
Hmm. And all due to generosity. And that's a wonderful thing as well. Well, Doc, this has been great fun. Thank you so much for being with us. It was lovely to speak with you after all these years.
Yeah, likewise.
Doc Searles, thank you, Doc. And his book has been published. He also has this great blog. So, you know, Google his name, Doc Searles, because he writes some very interesting things about, well, you know, about life and technology. And it's fascinating. The book is The Intention Economy: When Customers Take Charge. Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Thanks to both of them, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Remember, election coverage at 8 o'clock tonight.